Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141 and 96.3 HD2. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Gun violence continues to plague our community. That's not new information, but there are plenty of new examples to remind us. Just yesterday, a robbery victim tried to escape gun-wielding bandits by boarding a D.C. Metro bus. Also yesterday, D.C. police announced another arrest in the Mother's Day shooting of a 10-year-old girl who was riding in a car with family after celebrating the day. Well, tonight on Take Back Our Community Thursday, we'll hear from a mother who lost her daughter to gun violence and from an organization supporting victims of gun violence. That's coming up in just a bit. But first, a conversation with Maryland Congressman Glenn Ivey about addressing gun violence. Tomorrow morning, starting at 9 a.m., he's hosting a gun violence action summit at the Library of Congress. I asked him what prompted the summit.
Sure, two sets of things. One is, this is Gun Violence Survivors Week. So partly we're recognizing that, but also we're lifting up survivors in our community, people who've been shot but survived themselves, but especially parents or siblings of people, or relatives of people who've been killed due to gun violence, in a couple of ways. One is to talk about their personal experiences and what they had to go through to survive this. Two is to talk about what they're doing. Many of them are turning their pain into policy. They're working to make a difference in the community, trying to find ways to reduce gun violence, and part of that, they're working with us. So that's been helpful. And we're trying to expand the network, too, because many of them can provide informal counseling to other people who are, unfortunately and sadly, newly finding themselves in this survivor's community. Beyond that, we're trying to build on expanding policies, finding grants and funding to put out efforts to reduce gun violence. It might be intervention and prevention programs. There's some that we're going to look some at enforcement because I think that's important too. But I think the real focus in places where gun violence has gone down, including in Prince George's County when I was state's attorney, was when we expanded intervention and prevention efforts and did it in a coordinated way.
What kind of policy moving forward would you like to see that could make it through the difficult politics of the House right now?
Well, listen, I'll set the congressional legislation to the side for the moment. I mean, they're struggling to keep the government open, so I don't know that we're going to actually get gun bills out of those guys. I mean, they're having trouble bringing themselves to co-sponsor like ghost gun elimination kind of legislation. So let's set them to the side. But I think, some of the grants that have been proposed that the Biden administration is making available help to expand intervention and prevention programs. Violence interrupters are one of those that have been proven effective in other jurisdictions. We've got some of that in Prince George's County. We'd like to expand it out. Our hospital has a program that works in that capacity as well. We'd like to provide additional funding for that too. We've also got some data collection efforts that are going to start rolling out. And part of that is to make sure that whatever proposals we come out with, they're data-driven and evidence-based, as opposed to, sort of people throwing out, proposals. Sometimes they're just kind of knee-jerk reactions and pendulum swing kind of deals. We want to make sure that we put things out that are actually going to help reduce gun violence and do it in a way that doesn't take us back to the days of 2.2 million people incarcerated. We don't need to be the leading, leading nation in the world with incarceration. So we want to make sure we have the right level of incarceration, the right level of intervention prevention efforts, and make sure we're doing everything in a sort of a comprehensive and coordinated way to reduce gun violence.
That was Maryland Congressman Glenn Ivey. He's hosting a summit again tomorrow at 9 a.m. at the Library of Congress regarding gun violence in America. There are going to be several interested parties there. It is open to the public. Members, it's going to be in the members' room of the Thomas Jefferson Building again tomorrow morning at the Library of Congress at 9 a.m. Now, joining me now for a deeper dive into this issue are Tyrese McAllister, a mental health therapist and survivor of gun violence. Also, Lucretia Washington, a victim's advocate with the Maryland Victims Resource Center Incorporated. And lines are open. Give us a call if you have a comment or a question on this Take Back Our Community Thursday at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can text me at HFisherWHUR or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Tyrese, Lucretia, thank you both for joining me. I appreciate you coming in and talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to talk to you first, Tyrese, because you lost your daughter, Ayanna, to gun violence. She was 18 years old in 2017. My heart goes out to you.
Thank you.
For your loss. But before you talk to me about what happened, talk to me about who she was.
Ayanna was an 18-year-old college freshman, full of life. She graduated from Largo High School in Prince George's County. Younger sister. She played basketball. She was just an amazing girl. She had a smile that would light up the room. She had a personality that was just absolutely infectious. I knew she was special because, of course, she's my baby girl.
Of course.
But at her funeral, if you can imagine an 18-year-old who have over 2,000 people to show up at her funeral, she had impacted a lot of people even at a young age. And I had no idea. My husband had no idea how impactful she was to a lot of people. Every year we go to her grave twice a year. Well, we go more, but twice a year we have other people who are coming, and that's her birth date and her death date. And those children she grew up with still come every year. They show up for the last 7 years. They show up. So that speaks a lot about who Ayanna was in the community of Prince George's County.
But what was she to you?
Definitely my baby girl. She was just amazing. Like, it's really just hard to put it in words. Like, her presence is missed every day. Our household literally changed the last day she left. Like, knowing that she would not come back through those doors, it really changed our household. Many people don't survive. Many marriages don't survive when a child is murdered. And my husband and I just celebrated at that time 25 years. And we made a pact to not let this divide us. But truly, it changes who you are. I'm not just Yana's mom. Like, now I am a fighter. I've never really been a fighter before, right? I've been a server, and I still serve my community, but I'm out here in these streets, as Ayanna would say. I'm out here, right? Like, that's what she would always say. And I was like, girl, okay. You ain't out there. But she in these streets, and I do it in honor of her, but not for her, because there's literally nothing I could do for her or anybody else. What the fight that my husband and I have through our foundation, named after her, the Ayanna J. McAllister Legacy Foundation, is so that other people don't have to experience this difference in their home, so that other people don't have to go to a funeral or, like Congressman Ivy said, join this unfortunate club. This is a horrible club to belong to, but I'm so glad there was a club, because you absolutely feel lonely as a survivor when your kid or any loved one is taken from you. It can be a lonely feeling, right? Like, you are, I can't even find the words to describe it, but
There's a hole.
There's something truly missing. But the survivor community is amazing. I just don't want any more members. You know what I mean? There is more than enough of us. 3 months before Ayanna was killed, my cousin was killed by gun violence. And their parents are in this club, my cousins, and we had a church, we have a couple of church members who've lost children to gun violence. They're in this club, and so they were kind of there to welcome me or to hold me up, not so much welcome me, but we all feel the same. We don't want anybody else joining this club, but unfortunately, on a daily basis in the DMV and in other places, people continue to join this club, and it's awful.
Lucretia, unfortunately, is also a member of this club, in addition to being a victim's advocate with Maryland Victims Resource Center. She lost her 17-year-old brother mm-hmm. in 2005. Lucretia, talk to me, if you can, about the intersection of the loss of your brother and the work that you do.
I think definitely it intensified. I was already in the human service field, but of course, going through that process, you kind of really found where your footing is supposed to be. And my footing led me to dealing with the victims, whether that was their survivors, their children, their wives, you know, ensuring that they have the resources and the support that they need to deal with each phase. Because, of course, after the murder, you still have legal proceedings. You sometimes there's family members that do not have life insurance, or so all of these things are kind of left on the loved ones, which are the survivors. And I knew I wanted to be that person that I didn't have through my process. So I became that.
I did want to drill down a little bit more during this entire conversation. And I think this is so important when you're talking about, you know, people like yourself, well, both of you, but certainly, you know, Tyrese, no parent expects to lose a child.
Mm-mm.
This is something that is out of order.
Out of order. I love that.
And so when you and your husband, your family lost Ayanna, what did you need right away that you weren't prepared for?
If you don't mind, let me respectfully correct you. I didn't lose Ayanna. She was taken from me, right? Like, I mean, she was taken from me. And what I think there's a couple of things that people need is, and this is what totally helped me in a way that people wouldn't even understand. There was so much love around my family. I couldn't be angry, right? I couldn't be bitter. And of course, I understand when a lot of parents, when somebody takes something from you, you can be very angry. And want revenge and all those things. But it was so much love from my friendship circle, sorority, my husband's fraternity, our church members, our neighbors, that I really couldn't find any space to be angry. And so what I was able to do was forgive the person who killed Ayanna. And that was really good for me. I'm not saying everybody, that's going to be everybody's walk, because it's not. But for me, it was good because it allowed me to stay light and free so that I can turn this around. So I could, if I was angry, I would not have been able to do the things that I was able to do. And the things that I was able to do was not about me. It was about being able to serve my community and to be able to fight. Unforgiveness would have been heavy for me to carry. And you can't do it. I couldn't do what I needed to do with that level of heaviness. There were people I needed to support, my husband and my daughter being one of them. I had, at that time, I had 25 years in emergency mental health. I had actually been on the other side of the table and being a homicide responder, right? Like when there was a homicide scene, being on that side of the table. And so I needed to keep my head together to support my family and my friends who were absolutely distraught. But there were some other assignments I would just call them divine assignments that I believe God had given me in this work, similar to the other person. Like, there were some things I needed to do, and anger would not have allowed me to do that. So for me, that was what I needed.
But what I was talking about specifically were the hard logistics, and certainly the emotional support and help that you received was critical. Mm-hmm. That body of work, having, as you said, your sorority sisters, your church, your husband's fraternity brothers kind of wrapping their arms around you. But there were some hard facts, things that needed to be paid for, things that needed to be done. I want to talk about those on the other side of the break. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. This is a Take Back Our Community Thursday. We're talking about surviving gun violence. I want to thank Lucretia Washington for sharing a little bit of her story during the course of this conversation. Lucretia, thank you so very, very much. On the other side, we're going to talk about support for survivors of gun violence, what that support looks like, how far does it go? So stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm. That's on WHUR. This conversation on Take Back Our Community Thursday continues in just a bit. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight, another Take Back Our Community Thursday. We are talking about support for survivors of gun violence. My guests are Tyrese McAllister, mental health therapist and survivor of gun violence. Joining us now, Pauline Mandel. She is Director of Legal Services with the Maryland Victims Resource Center, Incorporated. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tyrese, before the break, I was talking about some of the kinds of things that your family needed to address right away after your daughter was taken from you. Like you said, you had the mental health piece because you had the support. But you also said that in your professional life you were, and this is difficult work, being a person who responds to homicides. So as you know, many of those people, those families that you serve, did not have the blessing that you did.
No.
They didn't have the blessing that you did. They didn't have the financial support. They did not have the
life insurance policies.
Yeah, they didn't have the village that you or your daughter had leading up. And so kind of walk me through this difficult work outside the emotional piece, because at some point you had to kind of put that aside and you had to put pen to paper and sit down with your husband and say, this is out of order, but this must be done.
Yeah.
Take me through that.
So we were fortunate to have insurance, but you're right, many people do not have insurance, and victim services will provide, and they did provide for us, an additional, I think at the time it was $6,000. I think they give more for homicide victims, but that is only for homicide victims who are not doing something out of order, right?
You said victim services from which?
My daughter was killed in Washington, D.C., but I believe it's standard across the United States, you know, give or take a few dollars. But if you are the victim of a crime, and in our case it was homicide, that victim services will provide a monetary contribution, right, that can help with funeral costs. Most funeral cost more than $6,000, but we were fortunate because we were well insured, right? That's not the case of most people. But one of the things I do want to talk about is if a person has a child that was acting out, not doing the right thing, right? Mm-hmm. That they don't get that, they're not privy to that. But that I don't like that because that's still a loss to that mother who was not out there necessarily doing something. And, you know, you don't always get to control or you know, be in control of what your kids do. So that's one of the issues that I had. Outside of finances, I think that's the main thing that I see. The community support is helpful, but the main thing that I see is the financial piece. Like, people don't have that. Now you have a lot of churches who will not have funerals because of the way people, the way these young people are dying, because there have been fights and
violence in the sanctuary.
Funeral. And I understand that. I mean, I understand you have to protect communities, but then where does a family member go to put their child at rest? And you can't, it's hard. I can imagine it would be hard as a mother to have to deal with the politics of what everybody else is doing when you're trying to make funeral arrangements for your child. And so it's those kinds of things that I think we have to really kind of figure this out. Like, how do we address these things for the grieving survivors? Like, what happens to those families?
Pauline, on the line, thank you so much for joining the conversation. Explain to me how the Maryland Victims Resource Center works. Let's say that in the event that a family has a child that's taken by homicide, for example, or an adult. It may not be a child. It could be a spouse.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, how might that family get in contact with this organization? Do you reach out? Do the courts, do police reach out? How does that happen?
Okay, our organization has been around for 42 years. We are established by Roberta Roper, whose daughter was a victim of homicide in Maryland in 1982. So our agency was really founded first on doing assistance for homicide families, all right? In the state of Maryland, and actually we also work in D.C., there are various ways people can get in touch with us. There are brochures that are given out by the police which have our information listed on them so people can call us directly. State's attorney's offices sometimes will do referrals. Hopefully we do some advertising. Over the last couple of years, we have tried to reach out more and more to the community. We are a statewide organization. We have 18 attorneys. We have 10 advocates. We have some people who do advertising and stuff like that. And like I said, we've been around for 42 years. So if they have any issues, it doesn't have to be homicide. We work with anybody who's a crime victim. So mm-hmm. if it's a sexual assault or domestic violence or whatever, our phone number is 301-952-0063.
Mm-hmm.
They can give us a call. They also can go online and they can do fill out a form that basically states what their issue is or whatever, and one of our advocates or something can get back to them within 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So in a situation when we're talking about homicide, some of the services that we offer are assisting them. Your other guest was speaking about compensation, criminal injuries compensation, which every state has. It's a state entity which will assist victims in situations, as she stated, such as homicide, sometimes domestic violence, various crimes. But people can apply for that. In Maryland, they give people $7,500 to put toward funeral expenses.
I have a question, yes. Pauline.
Sure.
What does that first contact look like, sound like?
When people call us?
Yes.
Okay. the first contact, first off, we assist anyone. There are no kind of criteria except you're a victim of crime. Okay, so there's no forms to fill out or anything like that. If people call in, what happens is they first speak to a victim advocate and they explain what the situation is. So the victim advocate can figure out, you know, exactly what their needs are at that moment. Now, when you're dealing with a homicide family, depending on where they are in the process, they may need assistance with funeral expenses. They may need help because someone has been arrested and they don't know what to do or what that means. That's why we have attorneys there who can assist them, answer questions for them. If there's going to be a trial, the attorney or the advocate can go to the trial with them and assist them, because there are rules and laws in place for victims, and victims have their own set of rights. And a lot of victims are not aware of that, and that is one of the most important things our agency does, is to let victims know, if you are a victim of a crime, there are certain rights that are yours. And that you have the right, for example, you have the right to be notified about any kind of activity in the court. You have the right to be in the court and know what's going on with your case. You have the right to do a victim impact statement, and that right was established by Roberta Roper across the entire country. You have rights to restitution. There are various rights that victims have. And they need to be aware of those. And one of the things our agency does is education on that with people so that they understand what they are entitled to. And our agency will work with them to make sure if a situation like this occurs with them, that they get those rights and that they get represented in court and they understand what's happening to them.
Mm-hmm. Tyrese, What kind of help did you and your family have After the funeral? Because I'm not wholly familiar, obviously, with the case surrounding, the death of your daughter. Was there an arrest? Was this person brought to justice?
No, we don't have a clue of who killed Ayanna. In the community she was shot, there were no cameras. And so we did go back to that community and encourage them to get cameras in that community, else we would take legal action, because that's not fair to the other people who live in that community, because it's a high crime area. We did have support, though. We did get victim services. They were very kind to us. We worked with the detectives in Washington, D.C. The chief of police was involved, because in 2017, too, girls weren't getting killed like they are in 2023 and 2024. We've had a lot of girls get killed, so that really was not happening. So we had a lot of support, and Chief Newsom at the time kept the case open. But I knew that when he retired and left D.C., they were going to close the case, because it really is... The person shot from a distance. There was no fight, no argument. So essentially, there are really no witnesses that have come forward. So it really would be a hard case to solve. I'm at peace with it, though, right? Because I don't always believe justice comes from a courtroom and a judge or even a jury and time in prison.
But I would say, though, as I said in the very beginning of this conversation, that there is always hope for justice in the legal system, because as we know, as just was reported yesterday, there was a second arrest in the killing of the 10-year-old girl from Mother's Day. That was almost a year ago, and I would say, for us in this business, because there are so many homicides, and it's almost like a horrific conveyor belt. But every now and then, as was the case yesterday, and this was an arrest, this person is still a suspect, but every now and then that conveyor belt stops, and they pull that case. because there have been arrests. And we see there are cold cases that are solved years mm-hmm. down the road. And so it is laudable for you to have peace. But always remember that someone outside of the family is thinking about your daughter
yeah.
and that life right. that was taken. You were going to say something, Pauline?
Yes, what I was going to say, one of the things our agency can offer is we do have a cold case piece because we have an investigator, a part-time investigator, who has been working with some of our cold case families. And his job is basically to go back and speak to different law enforcement agencies who were involved when these cold cases happened, and reestablish communication between family, law enforcement, and him in terms of trying to see if anything else has happened, if the family knows of any new developments, if the police have looked into anything, and keeping those lines of communication open. So far, we have been able to have one person's body exhumed about 2 months ago from a case of about 40 years ago to see whether, you know, what the cause of death was, because there was a, you know, in that particular case. So there are small successes, okay? But for us, what we found when you speak to the cold case families, one of the biggest issues is that there's no, after a certain amount of time, there's just no communication. And so what we work with is a different, Prince George's County, and like I said, we're a statewide organization, so we work with law enforcement across the state. To see if anything new has happened, if anybody has looked at the case again, if there have been any developments, has, you know, DNA samples or whatever. So we do try to do that. Another thing that we offer is we have a peer support group for families, survivor families, on Tuesday night, first Tuesday of every month. It's virtual, so people can do come in that way, or you can come to our, we have an office in Upper Marlboro, and we have people who attend there, and then we have virtual people who come from other parts of the state who talk together, because one of the biggest issues, and I'm sure that your guests would agree, is the isolation that happens when you have lost someone to homicide, because so we have our support group has been going for about 40 years. We have people that come and go. We have families that might come for a few years and then not come anymore, but then something happens that triggers it, and they come back again. But it's, you know, and for families who are just starting out in the process, it's helpful to have people who have been through the process be able to share with them, because, you know, this is a situation where, you know, if people who have been through it can at least talk to the people who are going through the process. We also have that, yes.
I did want to ask Pauline, away from the issue of homicide, but let us say for an example of sexual assault, for example.
Yes, sir.
How long might your organization be able to
work?
Yeah, to work with a victim of sexual assault, a survivor of sexual assault. I mean, does that last 3 months, 6 months, a year?
Oh, no. We have open legal cases that are going into 4 or 5 years, because when people come to us, like I said, it's a process. Like when they come to us in the beginning, there might not even be a defendant charge, right? And so we go through that process. They might need assistance with support, criminal injuries, you know, trying to get help, trying to talk to law enforcement, finding out what's going on. And then there's the process of if someone is arrested, then we work with them throughout the entire criminal justice system, the whole process. Sometimes trials. The way things are now, sometimes you don't do a trial for a year or two. All of that time we're working with them, trying to help them. Going, you know, if there's motions, hearings in court and all those things, we go with them to all of those. We accompany them to those. We go with them to the trial. We go through the trial process with them. If there's an appeal, we stay involved with the Attorney General's office. If there is an appeal, to find out what's going on with that. If a case, we are seeing a lot of cases in Maryland, and I'm sure D.C. is seeing the same, where people have been convicted, they've been given a sentence, and now, because of the changing of the laws, these cases are coming back again. So we are dealing, I'm dealing right now with two or three homicide families who the person has been in jail for 10, 15, 20 years, and now the case is being brought back again. And so we're going back to court with them again. So we have... I can honestly tell you, I have one case that I am working on. There was a mistrial the first time out, and it was a 9-month-old baby who was murdered, and we have just set a date again for another trial 8 years later. And I'm still working with that family, and we're going to get it done. We're going to get back to court in March, in May of this year.
So let me ask you this, because you've said a lot,
and I know I've said a lot.
Yeah, well that's the point that I'm making. You said a lot because you do a lot, and the thing that I keep hearing outside of the families that have been affected by these crimes, and we know that there has been a rise in crime across our area as well as. You know, and it's debatable about whether or not this is crime is up or down across the country. That's another conversation. But because you've said a lot, you're doing a lot. Do you have the resources to manage this?
Okay. What I will tell you is this. We've been in business for 42 years, okay? We started out Roberta still does the homicide peer support group. So, you know, so she's still in there. The way we are subsidized, the way we manage to continue our work is through grants. I write a lot of the grants. This year, I think we have 7 or 8 that we get funding from. That's, you know, we have no guaranteed income every year, but we have managed to start. When we started, there were probably 2 or 3 people. Like I said to you, we just added, we now have 18 attorneys, 10 advocates. I think we're up to about 30-some people in our office.
Yeah.
So we have continued to flourish, and the reason we've continued to flourish is because there is such a need, and we are only touching, you know, a small amount of all of the victims, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, if we had millions of dollars more, we could do more work.
Yeah, absolutely. You know?
But there is such a need for this, because when people come into the criminal justice system, they don't know what's going on. They have no idea what's going on. So the idea that somebody could sit down and talk to them and explain how the process works, what's going to happen, prepare themselves, because the emotional support that they need just to get through a trial is, you know, it's so hard. It is so hard.
And that brings me to something that I wanted to talk to Tyrese about, because you said in the very beginning of this conversation about the impact that you know this has on families, particularly married people,
mm-hmm.
and that you and your husband, you know, consciously decided, vowed not to let this break up your marriage.
Mm-hmm.
When you do the work that you do as, you know, a mental health therapist, how has the how has the taking of your daughter impacted the work that you do? And how have you, if you have, been able to use it to help other people?
I definitely think it's made me more fiery, made me more passionate. The thing that I find, though, I think that people usually are made aware of my story. And one thing that a lot of parents will say or survivors will say is I'm not you. Like, I'm not able to forgive, or I'm not able to be as resilient as you. I can't get out of bed. And I'm like, well, first of all, we don't have to compare grief or the response to the grief, right? And you can't even look at me and say that I'm not grieving, because there are people who have forgot that I lost my daughter, because I have been able to do what I call a bounce back. I'm radically resilient, mm-hmm. right? I lay on my floor and I cry and I roll around and look crazy. I just don't post it on Facebook, right? I don't post it on social media, but I'm struggling on a regular basis. But it's not a comparison, right? Like, you grieve how you need to grieve, and you do what you need to do as long as you need to do it. My journey is different. What I'm doing is what helps me. My husband doesn't do the same things that I do, right? And he has to have his own journey, and we don't compare our grief or our response to what happened. You know what I mean? And I think that's very important. Right. I think that that's one of the things that I was able to do that was very good, because while I forgave the person who killed my daughter, my husband was not there immediately, right? And I told him, you don't have to apologize about that. That was your baby girl, right? Like, that was your daughter. You know what I mean? And so you do what you need to do for you. And if anger is what is helping you right now, go with it. But you know, my journey is my journey. And so we have to really stop doing that. The other thing is, people will say to me, well, they just keep talking about it, and you don't do that. And I'm like, my journey is my journey. And if you can't be supportive to people who are in this club, then just get out the way. Don't do things that'll injure and say you should be doing this because Tyrese did that, or you should be doing this because somebody else is doing something. Just like people have said to me, you should run for office like Lucy McBath has ran for office. Well, that's what God told her to do. That is not my mission in life. Like, everybody has their own journey, and we've got to let people be able to do what they do, right? Like, politics is not my thing. I appreciate the politicians who are doing the work, because some of them are. Shout out to Congressman Ivey. I got to give him a shout out, because he is giving us an amazing platform to be able to give this message. And there's others, right? At the time, she was state's attorney, Angela Alsobrooks, right there in my corner, our county councilman, Calvin Hawk, is very much in our corner, and very much doing the work of gun violence in Prince George's County. I got to give a shout out to them. There are lots of politicians giving thoughts and prayers, and that's all they got is thoughts and prayers. But I have definitely interfaced with several people who are in politics, and they have talk the talk and walk the walk. But everybody's journey is so different, right? And every politician is not going to have the same level of response. And I don't need them to. Do what you're led to do, but do something.
With that being led to do, and you talked about the foundation that you and your husband started, how do you know that you have been able to help someone? What are the signs when someone has a similar journey, that similar pain, that similar loss? What's a win look like for you?
Well, one, they say thank you, right? They they let you know. They say, you know what, I couldn't have did this without you, or I saw you and I knew I needed to talk with you. So those things are extremely helpful. Our work really is to do prevention. I don't want people to have to say thank you. I don't even want people to know we existed, but because we put some things in place, your child didn't get killed, right? Like, or your loved one is still alive. Like, I am not a person that really even needs proof. If the numbers go down because kids have jobs, right? Like we do a program where we bring kids into the gym to play basketball and the kids are excited to be there. And they're like, thank you for this opportunity. We give them prizes and all kinds of stuff and they appreciate it. But what we did is gave them positive recreation for the day. But while they're in the gym, they also are interfacing with employers because we can't ask children to put down guns and they can't pick up something. I need children to be able to pick up a paycheck so that they can take care of themselves and help their families. So we are more on the prevention side as far as our foundation is concerned. We are doing some community work. We are trying to teach our community, the Black and Brown community, how to advocate that we want them to understand that being safe in your community is a human right. You have the right to be safe in your community. And what does that look like? Because I think a lot of people are, and you grew up in the county, so you understand snitches get stitches and we don't tell in our community. And that's something that's killing us, right? And it's okay until something happens to your family. Now you want people to talk. But so we got to address that. We address those types of things in our foundation. So we don't necessarily know like if people are being helped, but we'll know when the numbers go down. We still have a lot of work to do.
Tyrese McAllister and Pauline Mandel, thank you both for talking to us. As always, information about the foundation and the organization to support survivors will be on our website on Take Back Our Community Thursday after 9 o'clock tonight. We also want to thank Lucretia Washington for talking to us earlier. That is the Daily Drum for this Thursday, January 25th, 2024. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.